Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a look at the state of the solar industry in Arizona and a hat maker who's really on fire. But first, it's time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I feel a little out of place tonight, but I feel more at home here than in today's Republican Party. Has been kidnapped by extremists and devolved into a cult.
I call her comrade because she is a radical left Marxist. She wants open borders. She wants our country. I don't understand why anybody would want it, but she wants our country to be open to the world's criminals.
He's coming to Arizona to take a picture. But Arizonans and Americans across the country, they see through this.
When Biden was in there, RFK Jr. is hurting Biden more than Trump. And now with Biden out, it's actually hurting Trump a little bit more than Harris.
I'm grateful that the Supreme Court weighed in and that they've ruled in our favor and issued the stay so that only citizens will be able to register to vote going forward and voting in our election.
And joining me to talk about Arizonans at the Democratic National Convention, the state Supreme Court issuing rulings on which initiatives can stay on the ballot, and more, are Lorna Romero-Ferguson of Elevate Strategies. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning.
And former state lawmaker Aaron Lieberman. Aaron, good morning to you.
Great to be here.
So, Aaron, let me start with you. At the Democratic National Convention, wrapped up last night in Chicago. Last night kind of seemed like Arizona night.
Yeah, absolutely. It was incredible to see kind of the lineup of Arizona Democrats up there, starting with Gabby Giffords, which was like very emotional. She's clearly been working on her public speaking so hard and gave just a great speech. And it was lovely to see Senator Kelly right next to her and how he supported her. And then obviously Senator Kelly's speech was great, but Ruben Gallego's speech really made an impact, I thought, with all of those veterans coming out, including Senator Kelly and Tammy Duckworth and others. I think it was primed for the Arizona audience in kind of a great way of focusing on you know, hopefully future Senator Gallego in my eyes.
Lorna, is this an indication of how important Democrats see Arizona? That, I mean, there were other Arizonans who spoke earlier in the week, but last night, presumably big TV ratings, people waiting to see Vice President Harris. Three Arizonans up there?
Oh, 100%. I mean, Arizona's front and center for Democrats, and not just from a presidential perspective, but also with the U.S. Senate race with Ruben Gallego. And so it just goes to show that, you know, a lot's changed in the past few election cycles when it comes to Arizona. 10, 15 years ago, we were a flyover state for Democrats, right? And now you have two major races at play, and Democrats are really taking full advantage of the dynamics here in Arizona with the growing amount of swing voters that we have.
We had talked in the past, Lorna, about when, before President Biden dropped out of the race, that in Arizona, the polls were showing that former President Trump was ahead in the presidential race, but Congressman Gallego was ahead in the Senate race. And the concept of these Trump-Gallego voters, now that Biden is out, is that as much of a big deal, do you think?
I still think there will be Trump-Gallego supporters. I do think that now with Biden out and Kamala in, she has an opportunity to take some of those swing voters that might not, that are independents or, you know, maybe even moderate Republicans that will go Democrat for president, Democrat for U.S. Senate. So she has a bigger opportunity because now she's able to redefine herself and kind of distance herself from the failures of the Biden administration. You've been seeing that the past few days with the DNC, where there's not really much talk about what's been happening under Biden. It's more focus of what she wants to do on the future. But I do think that there's still going to be a segment of the population that supports Trump for the presidency because they're turned off by Kamala's economic policies, but will vote for Ruben because he's coming off as a much more moderate Democrat. And they're much more familiar with Carrie Lake, given that she ran unsuccessfully 2 years ago. And I don't think she's done much to speak to that swing audience to bring them over to her.
But by economic policies, you mean the tax cut for the middle class that Kamala's proposed? That's what's they're going to object to?
All of the tax increases that she's talking about as well.
For the highest income earners, for the billionaires. But literally, I think she said last night, 100 million Americans would get a middle class tax cut under her plan. Sign me up.
Well, so Aaron, I think to Lorna's point, how does Kamala Harris try to go about maybe taking some of those swing voters or trying to convince some of those Trump Gallego voters that instead of being a Trump Gallego voter, they should be a Harris Gallego voter.
Yeah. Look, my legislative district when I was in the legislature was exactly reflective of the state in terms of percentages. More Republicans than Democrats, independents who kind of decide stuff. What I saw overwhelmingly was what decided elections were the people who didn't like crazy at this point. And now we've got crazy on the Republican side with Trump and Carrie Lake and sane. And frankly, Joe Biden, to many people, just felt too old. And it kind of gave them pause to consider the crazy. We're back to a much cleaner race. And those independent folks, a lot of them are, you know, Republicans, but they're Republicans that actually want, you know, typical Republican things, not crazy MAGA voters. And they've shown again and again and again over the last two election cycles, they're willing to vote for a Democrat if the Democrat comes off as reasonable. I think Vice President Harris did a great job last night in actually being walking a very middle road on a whole bunch of things, presenting as a prosecutor. I mean, she's not like a community organizer, far left person. She's someone who locked up, you know, cartel members and other things like that. She's obviously leaning into that part of her biography now. And frankly, she's been given a gift of not having to go through a bloody primary, but showing up kind of at the last minute and can just talk about what she needs to win a national election. It's just like a statewide election in Arizona. You got to be somewhere in the middle to win here.
It's like a UK election, Lorna, where you get like 6 weeks to campaign. Yeah. Do you think that Kamala Harris's message last night will resonate with independents, moderate Republicans, rather, in Arizona?
I think so. And I that was intentional. I think her team was very smart about the topics that she covered last night. And I was actually shocked at some points that she addressed the border directly, which we know is the number one target. I mean, you had Trump at the border yesterday blasting Kamala Harris, and calling her a failed border czar and whatnot. And so she talked about that. She talked about foreign policy. She talked about her economic plan, which I think is going to turn some people off. But she talked, and then she's really trying to reframe herself as tough on crime, right? And so these are the things that Republicans have been hitting her on, and she took it head on. And I think that was very smart of her. But she did that in a very safe audience, in a safe crowd, right? You had 4 days of a pep rally, everyone loving her. And, you know, and she's coming off of now, I think, what's going to be the end of a honeymoon period, right? And so people are really going to look at her record, and not just her record as, you know, previous to the Biden-Harris administration, but she was part of the Biden-Harris administration. Mm-hmm. And people have a tendency to forget that. And so you're going to see Republicans now for the rest of, you know, this cycle tie her to the failed policies of Biden. And those were the things that were dragging him down with swing voters.
Again, maybe it's the like 12 million jobs that have been created that people are objecting to so much, or now the precipitous drop in illegal boarding crossers since they issued their new policy. I loved how she framed the border issue, which is exactly right. Democrats all lined up and were willing to vote for a bill that did not have a pathway to citizenship. Some things I think many Democrats, including myself, think would be important. It was a bill co-written by some of the most conservative Republicans in the U.S. Senate. It actually would have done something. And Donald Trump made a decision that he would much rather preserve a talking point for his campaign than actually resolve anything at the border. That is exactly how Democrats should be talking about this. If you want to get something done on the border, vote for Democrats, because they're the ones who are actually willing to get it done.
Just to go back to what you were saying about the economy and 12 million jobs, I think if you talk to the average voter, they're not feeling very good about the economy and their personal finances right now. Frustration with inflation, general cost of living increases, not being able to buy a home. So they're still fresh. I mean, I know all the politicians like to tout job numbers and this, that, and the other, but that's not necessarily trickling down. That's not necessarily trickling down to how people are feeling every single day when it comes to that. When it comes to the border, though, yes, numbers are down. We're also in the summer, right? And so border crossings typically go down in the summer. So we'll check and see how these policies are working in the fall. But it just goes to show it's been an epic failure over the Biden administration. They did something last minute to try to save his campaign or any hopes that he had. I hope it's successful moving forward, but when the fall comes around, we'll see if it's actually a good policy or not.
Well, so talking about the border, you referenced former President Trump was there yesterday. He'll be in the Valley tonight. He clearly also sees that Arizona is an important state for him to win. Do you get the sense that Arizona is more important for Trump or for Harris to win?
I think for Trump. For a few reasons, right? He won in 2016. He lost by a narrow margin in 2020, which he continues to this day to contest and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I just think for a Republican in general, losing Arizona is embarrassing, right? It's a completely winnable state with the right Republican, right? And, you know, as you've been mentioning, Aaron, we've seen this growing group of voters that are not afraid to vote for who they think is the better candidate, even if it's somebody of the opposing party, right? And when you have somebody who has continued to bash our late Senator John McCain, right? It does not resonate well with a lot of Republicans here. And so I think it's more important for Trump, from a math equation, for him to be successful than Harris. I think she has other paths to success.
When Lorna mentioned John McCain, he was referenced last night by Congressman Gallego in his speech.
It was awesome. It was awesome when Congressman Gallego said, John McCain is a hero, and he's absolutely right. And the simple fact of the matter that Trump said, you know, people who serve are suckers and losers, it's unforgivable. Honestly, from my view, it's disqualifying to be the commander in chief. And I think a lot of, again, those people in the middle are like, what are we talking about here? You're gonna speak with disdain about people who served in the military, particularly in Arizona. It is those McCain Republicans who decide elections, quite honestly. And I totally agree with Lorna. A kind of centrist, pragmatic Republican, you could be pretty conservative but not crazy, would likely win every time in a statewide election.
Like a Doug Ducey type Republican.
Yeah,
again, look at the numbers. You know what I mean? He did it. Amazingly, from a Democratic perspective, there hasn't been one of those types of people nominated to run statewide for attorney general or governor or U.S. senator in several cycles. It's the MAGA thing is the gift that keeps on giving to Democrats. Now, I will say we're also gotten pretty good at putting up candidates who are kind of in the middle. You know what I mean? And people who are more of that centrist bend, at least come off that way. And that's why Dems have been winning in the
state.
That's
what I was going to say, that come off that way. Because, I mean, you can make the argument. If you look at Ruben Gallego's record, probably not the most moderate, not the most moderate record, right? But he's running a very moderate campaign. He has learned from Kyrsten Sinema. He's learned from Katie Hobbs. He's learned from Mark Kelly what the path to success is in Arizona. It's to be much more centrist. And I think Democrats have done a good job of adjusting to that dynamic, and Republicans haven't, unfortunately, when it comes to statewide races.
So before we go to a break, let me ask you guys about one more bit of presidential politics, which is RFK Jr. is going to be in town today. He has, as my colleague Wayne Shutsky reported, filed papers to withdraw from the ballot just a few days after he submitted signatures to get on the ballot. The speculation is he's going to end his campaign and endorse Trump. Lorna, does that play a role here, do you think? Does that impact anything?
I mean, I think probably a small percentage of folks. I think there were some people that were just don't like either of their presidential options that were probably going to be like, oh, I'll vote for RFK, whatever, like meaningless throwaway vote. Now I think that's probably going to make them question their decision moving forward. Does it mean that Trump is going to pick up more votes? I don't know amongst the swing voters. I feel like maybe it helps solidify more of his base, because I feel like there was more similarity between Trump and RFK when it comes to, you know, some of the conspiracy theories and whatnot. And, you know, some of those what people think are more far right policies and things that they've been talking about. But I don't from the swing voters that we've been talking about, like the Ducey Sinema voters of 2018, like I don't think it moves the needle for that audience.
I think this might be the side in your campaign is taking on water when you're trotting out an endorsement from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. It is really weird. If people have a minute, they should look at this. For some reason, the video leaked of him begging Trump for a job. By the way, Kamala Harris would take his call. From several weeks ago. Incredibly, talk about unserious. Trump goes off on how horrible childhood vaccines are in that video. I mean, it's a crazy thing to see. Childhood vaccines, which have saved the lives of 150 million Earthlings, you know, and the guy who's running to be president, thinking he's catering favor with this two-bit party switcher, somehow, you know, is talking about how horrible child vaccines are. Like, this is a guy who could be president. To me, that's the scariest thing about this whole thing. I think it actually will help Trump to get him out of the race. I think the Kennedy name will make some noise overall, particularly in the endorsement. But let's just remember he called Kamala and she wouldn't pick up.
Interesting. All right. That is Aaron Lieberman. I'm also joined by Lorna Romero-Ferguson. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, former state lawmaker Aaron Lieberman and Lorna Romero-Ferguson of Elevate Strategies. Lorna, this week we got a little more clarity on which initiatives voters will be deciding in November. Let's start with the abortion access one. That was the first one of the week. The state Supreme Court said that could stay on the ballot. Presumably, I mean, Democrats are certainly hoping that this is a big turnout driver for them, which could help candidates up and down the ballot.
Oh, yes. I mean, it'll be it's really going to help, in addition to Kamala Harris now being the nominee. It's really going to help energize Democrats and even independents that this is an important topic for them. We saw abortion be a key issue, from a policy standpoint last election cycle. But now with it actually being on the ballot and being a decision that voters are going to make, it's a big deal. And that's probably the Achilles heel for a number of these Republicans that are in swing districts when you're looking at the Arizona legislature, because that is the issue that Democrats are going to use to paint them as extreme.
How far down the ballot do you think this could potentially help Democrats? Or do you think it could help, for example, legislative Democrats?
You know, it's really an interesting point. I think you see a lot of down ballot drop off, even in state legislative races, for sure. And people are not that focused on it. I think if you have very targeted mailers that are laying out that the Republican opponent is completely anti-choice, which is the case for almost every person running, perhaps, you know, except for one or two, that might tip some of those voters in those close swing districts. Again, some of those candidates in those swing districts know that and have kind of moderated their position on this. But I mean, for me, it's actually this whole thing is kind of a triumph of democracy, where we had a small group of people who felt very passionately by an issue try to impose it on the entire population. We've seen in places even like Kansas, this is just not where the vast majority of people are. They want women to be able to control their own bodies. And it is a, you know, it's not just like a winning political issue. It's also just, in my view, like some sort of basic human right. And you saw last night at the convention, I mean, Democrats are going to it again and again and again on a very base level, like hands off my body. And it's a winner.
Lorna, we heard former President Trump this week say that he didn't think abortion was that big of an issue anymore. Do you think it remains as big of an issue that electorally?
Yeah, and I'm not quite sure what prompted that reaction from him. But I mean, you've seen this, like you were saying, in other swing states where this has been on the ballot and it's been, you know, it's passed successfully by large margins. And you've seen that here in Arizona, looking at the polling and just look at the number of signatures they collected to get on the ballot.
A lot.
Right? Yeah. That's a lot. So, yeah, it's still a big topic. The topic never really went away when you think about it. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled. We were in this gray fog for a while. There's been lawsuit after lawsuit here in Arizona. There was the debate at the Arizona legislature this session about the territorial law or 15-week ban. And so it's consistently been a topic of conversation in Arizona, and even more so now leading up to November.
All right, so Aaron, let me ask you about the Make Elections Fair initiative. A little slightly less clarity on this one than the abortion access, because the Supreme Court yesterday ruled that it does not violate the single subject rule. So it is allowed to be on the ballot. But the Supreme Court also told the trial judge that he needed to look at more evidence about whether or not it collected enough signatures. So it sounds like we could be in a situation where it's on the ballot, people could vote for it, but those votes might not be counted if it's determined that there aren't enough signatures to have qualified in the first place.
Yeah, I have a point of view here. I should disclose I submitted a statement on the proposition to be in the voter guide for people on this. I'm totally in favor of this. I did talk to Chuck Coughlin on my way in here. I thought we might speak about this. He said it's on the ballot, and that there was some late breaking thing last night where even on the signature issue, which seemed to be the last issue, he thought was resolved. I don't know. We'll make a little news here, but I sure as heck hope it's on the ballot. And frankly, in a weird way, this could actually benefit those kind of centrist Republicans who have been locked out of the winning of primaries, but would be better general election candidates. I think it will also happen on the Democratic side. The biggest thing for me is letting our independents actually have a vote in helping decide who gets on that final ballot. And when we've seen this type of initiative in other states, it's very popular. It will definitely, I think, pass if it gets on there, despite there's been a lot of efforts by the Republican legislature to refer other confusing ballot initiatives. But most importantly, I think it'll help break the fever, you know, for everybody in letting the best candidate win and not being so locked into these party fights.
What do you think, Lorna?
Well, I mean, and mind you, I didn't see the breaking news that it's definitely going to be on the ballot now, because there are still 40,000, I think it's about 40,000 signatures that are in question of being duplicative, right?
I think that's about right. Yeah.
And so they've remanded that the trial court judge actually look at those, right? And it's a question of timing of whether ballots will be printed before that's determined or whatnot. So you're right. There could be a scenario where those ballots or those signatures are deemed invalid, and it's on the ballot, but you can't actually vote for actually going into place. But it's an interesting conversation and topic to have, right? This concept of open primaries and allowing anybody who's registered to vote for it, all of the candidates that are running, regardless of party, right? And to make it a much more fair and open race. There's a question of, okay, and they leave it open-ended intentionally to give the legislature the opportunity to decide, well, then how does the general election go? How many candidates move forward between 2 and 8? And how does this actually work in practice? What's interesting is how vehemently opposed Republican, like the party structures,
exactly,
Republicans and Democrats are against this, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, there's typically lawsuits when it comes to ballot propositions, but this one's getting it from every direction because you have the best lawyers on the Republican and Democrat side fighting it. I think it's going to, if this was the only question on the ballot or only a few, I think it would have a really good chance of passing because people wouldn't be inundated with the 13 ballot measures that look like they're going to be on, in addition to county questions. I mean, we're looking at a two-page front and back ballot, right?
Yeah.
And so we were talking earlier about voter drop-off, even with legislative races. Who knows what the drop-off is going to be by the time you get overwhelmed by a number of ballot propositions. And so it'll be interesting to see if the frustration that we always hear from politicos about the primary process and, you know, that extremes from both sides always get elected and how it's difficult for independents to actually have a voice in that process, if that's actually reflective of the electorate at large, if they're actually frustrated with the system as well.
Yeah, that is interesting. All right, just a few minutes left. I want to ask you about the U.S. Supreme Court weighing in on a law in Arizona about whether or not you can vote for certain races depending on whether or not you show proof of citizenship when you register. Basically, what the U.S. Supreme Court said is if you don't show proof, you have to fill out the federal-only form, which only allows you to vote in federal races, president, Senate, Congress. You cannot vote in state races. Lorna, a partial victory, I guess, for Republicans in the legislature?
And I'm so confused. Mind you, I am not an attorney, but there have been so many different rulings the past few weeks. And
yeah,
I mean, these poor county recorders and election boards that need to implement this. But I mean, this all stems from Arizona requiring proof of citizenship to register to vote, right? And there's been litigation lawsuits ever since that you can make that requirement for local
on the state
races
form.
On the state form. But not for federal races, right? And then there's been a push recently from Republicans saying, well, okay, maybe for, you know, congressional races and federal, but presidential races are different. We should be able to have our own rules for that. So there's been this confusing litigation. And so what I think it's 43,000 federal-only registered voters in the state. A lot of them are students that come from another state that re-registered to vote in Arizona, according to Secretary Fontes, that just don't physically have proof of citizenship. Like, they don't have their birth certificate with them on there. So I think there's still ongoing confusion about, in practicality, what this means. But now it's just they can vote, but federal-only races. So I don't see how it's different than what was happening before necessarily.
I'm still trying to look for, like, what is the problem we're solving for here? Has anyone ever had any evidence of non-citizens voting? Like, what is the problem? I don't really want citizens to vote, of course, but like what is the problem this whole thing is focused on? It was kind of a split the baby decision from the Supreme Court, and we'll see how that rolls out. But I mean, to your point, 43,000, I mean, Joe Biden won by 10,000. I don't think anyone thinks Kamala Harris is going to, you know, win by 20,000 if she wins. Like, these are really important things. And that's the thing on the other side. Usually, this is what frustrates, I think, a lot of people. It's an effort to put barriers between people who actually should be able to vote. And that's where you, like, yeah, everyone wants only citizens to vote, but we shouldn't unduly put up barriers that might discourage that ASU kid who, if they wants to vote here, has every right to, from actually casting that vote.
All right, so about a minute left, so I want to ask you each very quickly. Pretty much everybody agrees that this, at least the presidential race, will be won on the margins. Is this the kind of margin that could tip the race?
100%. And I think that's why there's so much attention from Republicans about this group of registered voters and trying to not allow them, at least in the presidential race, be able to vote in those races. And so I do think it's going to be a slim margin either way, whether it's Trump or Kamala. It's going to be very close in Arizona.
The last poll I said saw Kamala up by 5, which was like literally a 10-point swing. I have not seen a swing like that in Arizona politics in a long time. But I suspect in the end we're going to be in, you know, really, really close election, and it's going to be an interesting fall, that's for sure.
All right, we've got just a little bit of time left to watch all that happen. Aaron Lieberman, Lorna Romero-Ferguson, thanks you both for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, an arts collective explores where spirituality, migration, and political policies intersect. But first, let's turn to my co-host Lauren Gilger and the latest maker in our series, Made in Arizona.
I could take risk with embroidery in a way that I couldn't take risk in other areas of art.
A lot of my paintings, gravity doesn't matter a whole lot.
Dance wasn't something that is necessarily seen in galleries, you know? And I just remember being like, this is the key. This is how dance gets out there.
I try to tug at people's heartstrings and try to do something disturbing.
I escaped real life and I went back in time. Today, meet Jerry James, a Navajo hat maker who does it all out of her home studio in Gilbert.
It started as a hobby, so I do have a regular 9-to-5 job as well. So when I get home at the end of the day, this is what I like to do. It's kind of my little sanctuary.
Her hats are traditional and ornate at the same time, often embroidered or decorated, finished with a ribbon, a feather, an interesting lining. They're colorful, too, reflecting the colors of the desert we live in. Her company is called Sleep Rock, and she told me, for her, it all started there.
For me, it resonates in the name Sleep Rock Company. You know, it's who I am. So in our society, the Navajo or Diné, it's a matrilineal community. So we get everything from our mothers who get everything from their mothers, and it's passed down through generations. So my clan is Tenabithni, which translates to Sleep Rock. And I got that from my mom, and she got that from her mom, and she got that so long down the line. And so a lot of my creativity, I credit a lot to my mom. And her mom, my grandmother, she does a lot of that too. She does a lot of jewelry, she makes blankets, she does sewing. Pretty much anything anybody asks her to do, they'll do. Both of them are like that. So I credit a lot of where my creativity comes from them. And, you know, a lot of how I was raised and who I am now is because of my family. So I wanted that to reflect through Sleep Rock Company.
But why hats? Like, this is not an easy craft, right? This is a complicated process, as we'll see.
No, my mom's sitting over here, so yeah. She's kind of she's smiling at me because, you know, it's kind of her fault I got into this. Ah. So she, again, you know, she wears a lot of hats, both literally and figuratively.
I wondered. Yeah, that's what you were getting at there.
Yeah, and she loves to style everything that she has and make it very personal. Mm-hmm. And more than a few years ago, she started picking up hats, either at thrift stores or, you know, going to Target or anywhere and just finding hats. But she was putting her own flair to it. Mm. And I jokingly said one day, well, I'm going to learn how to make hats, you know, because you have all these hats here, but none of them are really your style. You can't find that one. We have to go everywhere to find it. Mm-hmm. So what I wanted to do was learn the process. I'm really into finding how things work and going back to the beginning. Mm. And I feel like if you want something very personal, you kind of have to do it yourself. Okay. So that's kind of how it all started.
All right. Well, so let's see the process here. Tell us what we're looking at.
Sure. So when we get a request, or even if it's just something that I want to do, you know, I have a lot of different colors to choose from here. And I have a felt supplier, and what I get are what's called a felt cape line or a cone.
So we've got a nice gray one here.
And from that point, when I pick a color, I want to get it in this makeshift box that I made here. And what we do is we hit it with steam. Mm. And I try to get that felt as soft or as warm as possible. Then from there, we go to a hat block. So it sits on top of a stand. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different videos. There's a lot of different classes, or there's a lot of different ways to do it. But I found a lot of things work differently for me, so I've kind of perfected that in my own way.
You can hear that steam going.
So the steam stays in, and we kind of centralize all of that heat right onto the felt, so that way we can work with it a little bit easier.
So talk a little bit about how it is that you went from sort of teaching yourself this just because you were interested in it, because of your mom's interest in it, to, you know, turning this into a business.
It kind of started more or less just something I wanted to do, and it turned into giving my mom and my sisters wanting a hat. Mm-hmm. So if you see their collection, it probably looks like this wall.
It's big.
It is. And then from there, you know, we just started posting pictures on a personal page, and people would ask, where did you get that hat from? And if I just tell them I make it, and they're like, wow, are you selling your hats? And
can I have one?
it was just kind of a more of a word of mouth thing. But I also have, you know, family members, aunts and uncles that are in business as well. And my mom, she sells a lot of her crafts as well online. So it wasn't anything new. We all kind of did it in one way or another. So just shows the resiliency of the family and anybody that's in arts.
So how's the steaming going here? This is looking really wet, I can tell, inside this box.
Wait a minute, let me get this other. Gotta have gloves because this is really hot coming out of the steamer.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. And let's do this one just for now.
Here, James pulls on a pair of gloves, takes the steaming felt out of the box, straddles a head-shaped hat block, and starts to muscle it into shape.
So this part's a little bit physical, I can tell. You're really pushing, stretching.
Oh, yeah. We got to make sure that it goes around that crown so we get that sizing right. I do this a few times. And then I get a piece of string with a hatter's knot and try to get the bottom part of that felt sized just perfect. So once that happens, you know, I work a little bit on that string and try to get it down as far as I can on the base of that hat block. Mm-hmm. Once I get it there, then I get to the iron.
So you flatten out the brim.
Iron down, coming out of the steamer, we have to leave it and let it dry for about 24 hours because it's still really wet and pliable. And if you start working with it, it can kind of mess with the felt a little bit. So you want to make sure that it's completely dry. Mm-hmm. When it dries up, I take it outside and I get the edge. We'll cut it. And so we have another couple tools here too. This one kind of helps me get that straight edge on the inside. If I'm not able to get it on the block very well, then I'll work it with some steam here with the iron. Mm-hmm. And then just go around here on the edge and just make sure that right in the, where the brim line breaks, that we get a straight edge. Once we have that part of it done and it's dried, I'll take it outside and hit it with sandpaper. Once we get all that felt down and to a texture that I'm comfortable with and it's really smooth and even all the way around, then I'll just give it a little spray and light it up.
Wait, on fire?
On fire. Yeah, it's just a little bit of alcohol just on top of the hat. All it's doing is just grabbing the excess fur that I was able to get off and gives it that really silky smooth texture.
So you mentioned your mom, your grandmother, the kind of line of creativity through your family and where you're from. Where did you grow up? Did you grow up on the Navajo Reservation?
I did, yes. So I can say confidently that I'm both from Arizona and New Mexico. So I was born in Arizona, in Fort Defiance, Arizona, on a Navajo Reservation. But my mom's family is originally from Pruitt, New Mexico. I went to school in Arizona, but a lot of my early childhood was spent in Pruitt, New Mexico.
What are your memories of that? Like, it seems to me that at least the very much the color scheme here looks a lot like Arizona, New Mexico to me.
Yes. A lot of memories from my childhood is being with family. If that was just hanging out with grandma or walking down the road, hanging out with some cousins, there was a lot of family gatherings. There was sheep herding. We would go to the lake a lot for holidays and we would spend time with more extended family. And you had the lakeside, you had the mountain ranges, you had animals, beautiful sunsets in both New Mexico and Arizona. So I think a lot of that comes through in my art.
The blues of the lake, you can see the sunset colors here, lots of deserty kind of purples and oranges and tans. It makes sense.
Yeah. You don't see too many cowboy hats here because they sell really quickly.
Is that why?
A lot of our family is in rodeo as well. So, you know, felt hat was a staple in the family.
So there's so much technicality that goes into this. It reminds me of sort of like talking to somebody who makes jewelry, like out of taking, you know, metal and melting it down and shaping it, right? Like there's a lot of taking something and turning it into something else here.
And I think that's, again, that's why I really picked it up and I enjoyed it. It's because you know exactly how something's made. And I'm pretty passionate when it comes to this style of art. And I found it really late in life, but I'm going to continue it as long as I can.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for showing me around, and I appreciate you telling us your story.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And it was fun. Thank you.
You can see pictures of Jerry James hats on our website and check out the other makers featured in our Made in Arizona series. Just head to theshow.kjzz.org. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Arizona has long been seen as a potential leader in solar energy. But data show the state is lagging behind some other states in terms of the rate of homeowners putting solar panels on their roofs. Advocates are asking utility regulators to avoid policies that make it less economically advantageous for potential customers to go solar. But my next guest is concerned about the future. Autumn Johnson is executive director of the Arizona Solar Energy Industries Association, and she joins me. So, Autumn, what are you seeing in terms of the rates of residential solar use, either by buying panels or leasing them?
So I get data from an organization called Ohm Analytics, and then they provide actual Arizona residential solar permits requested by month. And so that's how we can tell a general trend in installations or not. And so per month, we're looking at about 1,500 applications, which is a decrease of 31% year over year. And that's as recently as May. And that is the lowest level of residential solar installations in Arizona since 2021.
Why is that, do you think?
I think it's a combination of factors. So obviously, a lot of folks are not able to just purchase solar outright. And so there is either a lease or some sort of financing involved. And, you know, it's been a topic of significant conversation of late about interest rates. And so when interest rates are north of 8%, obviously that is going to dissuade a number of people from installing solar if they would have to finance it, because the overall cost to them over time is going to be significantly larger. It is unfortunate because you're in a situation in which you have all of these great Inflation Reduction Act, IRA tax benefits that apply to individual homeowners installing solar, but you still have these other larger sort of macro issues that impact solar. So the interest rates are one of them. You have issues with trade tariffs are another. And then I think a really significant factor that I don't think we talk about enough is specific policies related to solar. So these are Arizona specific numbers, and things like interest rates apply nationally, obviously, but in Arizona, we have kind of a confluence of policy decisions that make solar less and less attractive to ratepayers, you know, because of specific decisions of our utilities and our lawmakers.
What are some of those solar specific policies that concern you the most?
Well, there are a few. So we're in a situation in which the state largely continues to decrease the export rate that you receive when you sell your extra solar power that you've produced on your home back to the grid. So in the majority of the country, you're paid a retail rate or something called net metering for the extra power you pay back. In Arizona, they pay something called an resource comparison proxy, or RCP, and it is a declining rate. That applies to TEP and APS. And so every year that you install solar, you're getting 10% less than your neighbor who installed solar the year before. And so now I think with APS, we're somewhere in the 6 or 7-ish cent range for the export rate. And then they're doing that at a time when they're increasing the fixed fees that solar customers pay. So in February, the Corporation Commission just approved a new fixed fee called the grid access charge for all of APS's solar customers. And that basically applied a 15% additional rate increase to all solar customers above and beyond what all other residential customers paid from that rate case.
So it seems like economics is playing the biggest role here in what we're seeing in terms of a decrease in the rates of people who are choosing to incorporate solar into their homes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of reasons why someone might want to install solar, right? Some people are probably going to install solar because they are concerned about kind of an energy independence resiliency benefit. And so if that's of interest to you, you're going to pair that with storage, battery storage specifically. If the environment is a motivating factor for you, you could install solar. But for most people, they install solar because they want to have some sort of certainty or control or reduction in their electric bills. And so if the economics, because there are increased fees or decreased export rate for the extra power, if those all are combined and it costs more to go solar than you save from your electric bill, it dissuades customers from doing so.
I'm curious how Arizona's decrease that you mentioned, how does that compare to other states that are also looking at solar, specifically, you know, other states that have a lot of sunny days like Arizona does?
That's a good question. I don't have the same, I don't get the same data from Ohm Analytics regarding surrounding states, because ARCA really just focuses on Arizona policy, but mm-hmm. There's been a lot of media, obviously, on changes to California's solar export rate policies. It's called NEM 3.0, and I don't have the most recent data on that, but their market was said to be down 80%. Other states, I think it's about 35-ish states still have net metering. And so that is an interesting comparison to see how those states are growing as far as solar goes versus states like Arizona, in which we have basically eliminated net metering, or we've modified it in a way to be much less economic for solar installations.
Well, it seems like there's a certain irony in the fact that Arizona, which has, what, 300 plus days of sunshine every year, having a decreasing amount of people who are choosing or able to choose to use solar energy.
It is. I often tell people that you wouldn't expect that being an advocate for solar energy in the sunniest state in the country would be such a difficult job, but it really is extremely challenging. The headwinds are numerous. We are about fifth nationally for solar capacity, and we really should be like third, right? I don't know if we're going to compete as much with Texas and California, kind of given their size, population, and just sort of economics. But generally, we should be at the leader, a leader, right? The sun doesn't cost us anything. We have over 300 sunny days a year, like you said. And so it makes sense to maximize a resource that we are plentiful with. And I think that there are ways to do it that are a win-win for everyone. But unfortunately, ideology a lot of times has become an impediment to what could be a very good economic opportunity for Arizona.
Well, so I wonder then, given sort of the makeup of the Corporation Commission and the makeup of the state legislature, at least as it's constituted right now, assuming that policies stay the way they are, would you anticipate that we're going to continue to see fewer people choosing solar?
I think that we're in an interesting quandary. We are in a situation in which a growing amount of city councils and county supervisors, as well as legislators, are suspicious or outrightly hostile to utility scale solar. At a time when the utilities want to build more utility scale solar because it is least cost, it's market ready, and they can build it relatively quickly, and they're seeing increasing load growth. You also have corporation commissioners sort of, I think, deeply suspicious of their interest in building utility scale solar. And so you have that combined with these headwinds we've already talked about with residential rooftop solar. And yes, I'm deeply concerned about the direction that our elected leaders are taking us in what really could be kind of a no-brainer win-win in a really sunny state.
All right. That is Autumn Johnson, Executive Director of the Arizona Solar Energy Industries Association. Autumn, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Next week marks the close of an ambitious show at the University of Arizona's Center for Creative Photography. The show's Sam Dingman went down to check it out.
So we're looking out across a desert scene, which if you're from southern Arizona or familiar with it, will look very familiar to you. There are some mountains in the distance, or a couple mountain ranges. And in the foreground, there is a small peak or hill with a white cross on top that looks like it's maybe made out of metal. On top of that cross, there are four young boys that are standing on the cross piece, holding on to the middle, holding on to each other.
They perch up there in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. They sit with no fear of falling. They are safe in the arms of the cross, safe in the prayers that always begin with, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost.
I'm in Tucson at the University of Arizona's Center for Creative Photography. I'm on a tour with Denise Brito.
I'm currently the Learning and Engagement Manager here at the Center for Creative Photography and the co-curator of the exhibition.
And Julie Swarstad Johnson.
I'm an archivist and outreach librarian at the Poetry Center and another co-curator for the exhibition.
The exhibition is The Place Where Clouds Are Formed, and it's on display in two sections, one here at CCP and the other just across the campus at the Poetry Foundation. One of the goals of this show, Denise tells me, is to allow both mediums to enhance each other.
Photography and poetry in conversation.
That conversation began a few years ago between three artists. Gareth Smit, a South African photographer who took that picture of the boys on the cross you just heard described. Ofelia Zepeda, a Tohono O'odham poet who wrote and recorded the poem you heard about the photograph. And Martin Zikari, an Argentine writer and researcher.
And it didn't start as an exhibition per se. It started as a project where the three of them were interested in researching the land.
The artists wanted to illustrate how the lives of the Tohono O'odham have been transformed by the U.S.-Mexico border, which created a heavily guarded barrier between two regions of the ancestral O'odham homelands.
And that's only gotten more complicated for them over time as the border has become much more rigid and militarized.
As they began documenting life on the Mexican side of the border, the artists were wary of the power dynamics of a project like this, especially since neither Gareth or Martin are Tohono O'odham, and they wanted the community to see this work as a collaboration.
Instead of you, Sam, sit there, I'm going to take your picture and walk away, then I say whatever I want to say about you, right? Sam likes to wear pink shirts all the time, or whatever.
Admittedly true, but...
whatever I want to say, right? Like, I now have this power.
So if I'm hearing you right, the motivation was to document the community for the community rather than to show the community to outside eyes.
Yes. We're shifting that idea of it's a singular point of view. It's more everyone's voice and ideas are equal.
That's interesting. That's not what I was expecting you to say, because I guess what I was expecting you to say was going to be that this is giving power or at least primacy to the community in that dynamic. But what you said is that it's equal. It's that there's an acknowledgement of the community that is being photographed or written about, but there's also an acknowledgement of the artist being present there and that being a valid thing as well.
Yes. Everyone will take pictures of whoever they want, right? But like how you approach that, how you go about that is, I think that's what making it more intentional is what matters at the end.
We arrive at a photograph taken in a small village, which was largely abandoned in 2015 after an outbreak of cartel violence. The image shows a pickup truck with its rear window smashed.
And is the suggestion is that that was part of the cartel violence that led to that?
Yeah, or at least part of just the aftermath of that community. On one window, it maybe even looks like a bullet, a strike of a bullet breaking the glass.
I can't help noticing in this, the image is taken from inside the truck.
True.
Not outside the truck. So it's what the damage to the truck would have looked like to the person who owns it, not some outsider being like, oh my God, that truck has a bullet hole in the window.
You know? No, that's really true.
Long before The Place Where Clouds Are Formed came to the Center for Creative Photography, it was first shown in a village where many of the photographs were taken. At CCP, one of the images is a scene from that first exhibition.
We're in the interior of a house in Quitovac, Mexico, that looks like it's maybe like a semi-open kitchen. The walls look like they might be made out of saguaro or ocotillo ribs. And in the foreground, there is a woman cooking. She looks like she's probably cooking over a fire because there's a cloud of smoke coming up. But she is bent over what she's working on and appears to be tasting it. Her hand is to her mouth, and she has a look of concentration.
On the wall next to the photo, which Gareth took, Martin has written a recollection of the day the photo was taken. I asked Julie to read it.
Corn pozole and fresh hibiscus tea, flour tortillas and beans. Half of the family stayed at Mrs. Herlinda's house with the preparations. A van came and went to Sonoita and Quitovac with everything needed to feed more than 20 people. The rest of the town came to see the photography exhibition, listened to the poems in O'odham, photos upon photos, familiar faces looking for familiar faces in the images. Someone in the town had died, so mourning was required. The event was ending, and the true reason for the art was manifested in that pozole smoke. I remember the afternoon with that smoky flavor of corn, full of pozole broth, the sweetness of the hibiscus, the sun at the end of the day, and almost newborn puppies running through the dry, dusty street.
I feel like, you know, this image we see this woman captured in a very real, authentic moment. She's cooking food, she's tasting it because she wants to make sure that the people she's going to serve it to will enjoy it.
Yeah.
It's like she's the reason that we're here to take this photograph.
And also that we have the photograph. It's a beautiful photograph. This is one of my favorites. But at the same time, it's actually that whole story around it that's important.
Right.
Having that context really actually I think brings you into that scene in a really much more complete way and says, this is real life. These are real people that we were with and that who were aware of what we were doing.
The place where clouds are formed is on display through August 31st at the Center for Creative Photography. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
And that'll do it for this Friday edition of The Show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayanna Hamilton, and reporter Sam Dingman, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor. Chad Snow, the news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday. For this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.